I would like to think, over the last almost 20 years of my marriage, that I've really been successful in communicating to my husband that he is special, that he is significant, that he is important. But I think in reality, I have often failed at that. I have failed because I have allowed my fear to block me from taking the necessary risks to keep my marriage vow.
Welcome again to Christianity at Work, the radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber have been discussing the many ways we may break our marriage vows. Central is the idea that we need to make our spouse the most important person in our life. This involves communicating that he or she is special. But experience shows that this can be very difficult. It is risky, and it involves being vulnerable. Now let's listen to Jack and Christine and their discussion on marriage.
In the last few weeks, we've been addressing the area of marriage. We've talked a lot about what marriage is, and for the last couple of weeks, we've talked about how do we break our marriage vow. We're doing that as a way to get at what marriage is about and how to work toward oneness in our relationship with each other. But before we get to that, those of us at Christianity at Work and the radio station would like to thank people for your responses. We've gotten quite a number of calls and requests for tapes and just a lot of input that has helped us in producing this program. So we thank you and encourage you to continue giving us feedback. It's very helpful to us. So how about if we go through the outline of where we've gone so far, Jack?
Okay.
And look at what our marriage vow does imply and then how we break our marriage vows. Do you mind going through the outline real briefly?
No, not at all. I'm basing this outline on Genesis chapter 2, where the text says, "A man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." And out of that, I'm abstracting basically two fundamental principles that are sort of the essence of the marriage vow. One is that we are committing ourselves to a real intimate connection with one another as husband and wife. That's the whole one flesh idea in that statement. So I am committing to my wife to seek to know her, to understand with her, to understand her, to see life through her eyes, to perceive what she perceives, which is work, because she's different than I am. She's a woman, I'm a man, she's a different individual than I am. So it's quite a commitment that we're making in marriage, to connect with that person as intimately as we can. And to strive to do that is my pledge, that's my promise. So the one part of the outline that we looked at is that part of my vow is to do the work of becoming one with my partner. The second part of it acknowledges how different my partner is, my wife or husband. I'm making a commitment to respect that difference. So this becoming one is not to be mistaken for remaking my partner in my own image and try to make them a clone of myself. It's not that. In fact, that's a gross violation of my marriage commitment. It's a commitment to understand them on their own terms, or another way of putting it, to understand them on the terms in which God created them, to understand them as an individual worthy of my respect. So that was the second one. I'm becoming one and striving to become one, and I'm striving to become one in the context of respecting them as a different person than I am. And then I think the third one we looked at has to do with the notion of leaving father and mother and cleaving to wife. And I think the reciprocal is true, that the wife leaves father and mother and cleaves to husband. And I think that's trying to get at the nature of the loyalty between a husband and wife, that a husband and wife will know no higher loyalty, no higher human loyalty than to their spouse. And we talked about the ways in which we can violate that by not granting to my spouse the loyalty that I have promised.
Jack, as you go through that outline, I'm impressed with your ability to really think through the Genesis passage and put a real practical understanding to each of those things. It is very refreshing to hear your overview of what we've been talking about.
Good.
Okay, so the ones for today.
So related to the last point about the loyalty to my spouse is a close corollary to that, and that is I am promising my wife that I am going to lacking a verb here. Celebrate her specialness, affirm her specialness, communicate to her her specialness. It seems to me that mankind is created with a need for honor, for respect, for affirmation, that something deep in the human soul, deep in the human psyche, wants to be special to someone, wants to be, we often describe it in terms of wanting to be needed, or wanting to be important, or wanting to be significant. We use those kinds of that kind of language. And it seems to me that one of the ways God has put all this together is in the context of marriage. Everyone has the possibility in marriage of being special in the way that their heart longs for.
You know, as you're talking, Jack, I'm thinking that the terms you're using, some of which were affirmation, significance, importance, respect, some of those are kind of contemporary psychological terms that we might hear.
Mm-hmm.
And they might seem anti-biblical to some people, or not really what the Bible says, but more what our culture says.
Mm-hmm.
So can you back up a little bit here and talk to us about where in the Bible God talks about us needing and it being valid for us to want affirmation, significance, importance? And I think it's that in contrast to the fact that we're supposed to take up our cross and die to ourselves.
Okay. Well, there are several places we could go. One, for example, is in Romans chapter 2, where Paul is describing the judgment that we are all going to face at the end of time. And he says, for those who by perseverance in doing good seek for glory, honor, and immortality, the reward is going to be eternal life. But to those who by now my memory's going to fail me, but by selfish ambition and something or other pursue disobedience, it's going to be wrath and indignation. So he's describing the judgment in the time. And the people that are going to be rewarded with eternal life, he describes as those who seek for glory, honor, and immortality. Hmm. Now, glory is not a contemporary term, and it's certainly not a modern, hip psychological term, but it's a very, very common New Testament term. What I would argue, though, is that what they mean by glory is very, very similar to what we mean by things like significance, meaning, affirmation, and so on. That's what they're getting at. Glory is being a shining individual. Glory, I think, is correlated with like the shininess of light in the New Testament, and that's what this human psyche craves, is that in the end, I want to be a shiny person. I want to be awe-inspiring and startling for some quality that makes me stand out and makes me an individual who has a right to exist as an individual that doesn't just get absorbed into the mass of humanity and is not noteworthy. We want to be noteworthy.
We want to be noteworthy in the sense that we have glory, and glory means that we are people who are loving, people who are just, people who are giving and kind, thoughtful.
Right. Yeah, that's actually, we want glory any way we can get it. That's our problem. The kind of glory,
our sinful problem is we'll try and take it any way we want.
Exactly.
But the glory God wants is different.
Exactly. The glory that God wants us to have in the end is an eternal glory that is the very glory of his own character. He intends to impart that to us. And when he has imparted that to us, we will be intrinsically awe-inspiring, noteworthy people. We will be glorious. You know, most people, if they know anything about theology, realize that there's the concept of justification, there's the concept of sanctification, there's the concept of glorification. And most theologians, having looked at the New Testament, would tell you that in the final analysis, what God intends to do is to glorify us. What a lot of Christians don't realize is what that consists of. That glorification is becoming godlike with respect to my personal integrity, so that my character becomes so perfected, so morally perfected, that I become glorious with the very moral perfection of God himself.
Now, I think that in knowing you, you don't mean that I'm going to be perfect here on earth.
Not on earth, no. Glorification is really only something that I will attain to in the life to come.
what God wants from us is to be people who are reaching toward being people with a character that has integrity. Not a shiny exterior, but a shiny, so to speak, interior.
Right, exactly.
Having said that, let's just take a few minute break and come back.
Almost 20 years ago, the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, McKenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant: a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The McKenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at McKenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter, News and Views, are also available. Information about how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
Right before the break, we were talking about God wanting us to be committed to being glorious people, which means being shiny on the inside, having a character that's full of integrity.
Yeah, and the way we got there is I was making the claim that desire for that glory is something that is built in, is innate, and is a far-reaching kind of human need and human desire. In the context of marriage, then, part of that need gets met, certainly not my ultimate need. My ultimate need can only be met by the glorification that God is going to bring me in another age outside of this life. But here and now in this life, there's still an aspect of that need for glory that can be met in the context of marriage, where to my spouse I am glorious. To my spouse I have that special significance and importance that they are constantly celebrating and affirming in my relationship with them. And I would argue that that's fundamentally the joy of marriage. That's the reward of marriage, is to have someone who is so much on my side, who is so much my fan, that I am living constantly with that I'm being bathed in that affirmation of being important and significant and special to someone.
I'm thinking I'm being buoyed mm-hmm. by that.
Yeah, exactly. I make my way through the suffering and hardship of life being buoyed up by my partner's affirmation, exactly.
So many times in my counseling, I see spouses who are not buoying each other up. In fact, they're tearing each other down. And it's really a delight for me when I see one partner really struggling, really going through the desert or a really dark place, and what an incredible difference it makes to them when their spouse is alongside them, encouraging them, being with them, sometimes very confused what they're going through, but nonetheless supporting them to the very best of their ability. In fact, if I can get husbands and wives to come together and do that, I find that they're a much more significant therapist to their spouse, and just in the sense that they're supporting them, than I am. And I think that it makes a huge difference in their ability to go on and get better.
Mm-hmm.
And I especially see that when often one spouse will think that the other one is very together when there's we see it both ways. Spouses will see each other as very not together and very awful, and then we'll sometimes I see marriages where one spouse thinks they're really a mess and the other one is really together. So when the one who appears to be really together comes in for counseling with them and is willing to expose themselves and work on their own issues alongside their spouse, wow, what a difference that makes to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I can only do that when I am really working toward and thinking about making my spouse a special person and not just selfishly looking at my own needs and my own interests.
Right, right. So that's why I include this as an aspect of the marriage vow itself. It just seems to me that that's fundamental to what we are promising each other as husband and wife, is that I'm going to make you the most special thing in my life. I will ultimately sacrifice anything that this life has to offer in order to be there for you, to affirm you, to let you know that you are significant to me. That's the ideal, and of course we all fall short of that at times in our life, but the question is, have we taken that on as an idea? Have we taken that on as an ideal that I'm striving toward?
I really appreciate you saying that's an ideal, because I think, you know, I know you and I understand what you mean by us striving toward making our spouse special, but I think people who are listening to us don't necessarily know that we are major flub-ups ourselves, mm-hmm. and that I'm speaking for myself, but you're saying yes over there with your head, that we both make really big mistakes all
right.
the time.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I don't make my spouse special a lot of the time. In fact, I find myself to be incredibly selfish and wanting to pull in and do things for myself daily. And it takes a real work to get outside of myself and work toward really looking at Larry and what his needs are, rather than just be absorbed in my own.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That's just an aspect of human sinfulness that, like we've talked about before, human sinfulness is a kind of gravity that drags us away from doing the right thing. And it certainly is operating in all of our marriages to drag us away from keeping our vows in the way that we have taken them on. It may not be for lack of having taken the vow seriously, but just...
lots of times our own human weakness.
Our own human weakness just takes us the other direction, exactly.
I was thinking of an example. I shared last week that my husband was caught in a snowstorm and now he's back. And while he was gone, I thought, boy, he could get killed on the airplane coming home in the snowstorm, or he was gone 2 weeks and something could have happened. And I think I kind of moved away from being a married person, in a sense, during those 2 weeks, and kind of walled myself off a bit without knowing I was doing it. So Larry came home and I was actually really excited to see him, but really found myself holding back. And he noticed it and said, "Christine, you know, why are you holding yourself back?" And I came to understand that what I was doing was holding myself back because I was afraid that he could die and was thinking someday he will die and then I'm going to be by myself, and I selfishly didn't want to be vulnerable to him or make him special or look at his needs. I was just coming back and covering myself and trying to keep myself from the inevitability of hurt. And I think that's a real example of what happens in our everyday lives. We hold ourselves back in our selfishness. But what Larry said to me there was, you know, "Christine, don't rob me the opportunity to be loved and for us to have a loving relationship while we have it." And it really, that's a really wise thing for him to say. And I need to take the risk to be vulnerable to the relationship and open up once again.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. There's no way that we can obey this vow, that we can keep this vow without putting ourselves at risk. Because at the same time that the marriage promises to give us the reward of being bathed in this affirmation from the other person, mm-hmm. at the same time we face into the prospect that what happens when they're gone, which is always a possibility, one way or the other. And the risk of what happens if I go to them for this affirmation and they reject me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a danger. And it's our fear that will often step in at that point and motivate us to not keep this vow,
mm-hmm.
to not allow the other person to make me special, to stiff arm them, to, as you put it, wall ourselves off, or to not keep the vow myself because I don't want to get hurt one day.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're right, that fear really is at the basis. Fear that is, its genesis is in sin, but nonetheless our fear is what keeps us from being willing to enter into our marriage vow in the way that we need to, and to stick with it. Lots of times, fears are based on a reality that's happened in our life, and I don't want to overlook that as though it's an easy thing. Lots of times people have been abandoned or betrayed or rejected, and in their early life or even in the context of their relationship today with their marriage partner. And so to be willing to come back over and over again and take risks is a very, very big part of the marriage relationship, and a very, very difficult part.
And I ultimately, it seems to me, the only way we can do that, the only way we can face into the fear of life and the risks that we're required to take, is to know, understand reality. I mean, you said that our fears are rooted in sin. I don't know if that's obvious to people. I mean, it just seems
maybe you
so
need to
natural.
Unpack that.
Yeah, because it just seems so, we're so easily fearful. Why would we call that sin? A lot of people have a lot of trauma in their life. A lot of people have undergone a lot of horrendous things and have experienced a lot of horrendous things. How does God expect us to interact with them? I think he expects us to interact with them by beginning to get a clue about what human existence is all about, who God is in relationship to that, who God is in relationship to our suffering. In other words, in biblical terms, to become wise. And out of our wisdom comes the ability to face into the difficult times of life, the suffering of life, and say, I'm not going to like this, I'm not looking forward to this, this stresses me out completely, but I'll go there. If you and your wisdom want to take me there, God, then I must go there, and I will go there. It's the balking at going into suffering, at facing into suffering, where my fear literally leads me to rebellion against it. My fear brings me to a point where I say, no, I will not go there. I'm going to do everything in my power to prevent myself from going there. That's the heart of the sin in us, where we will not allow ourselves to be molded and shaped in the crushing hands of a loving God. We won't allow him to do that, or at least we try to not allow him to do that.
Well, earlier I talked about taking up our cross and dying to ourselves, and that's really what you're talking about right now.
Yeah, exactly.
That facing into our fears and being vulnerable to what is very, very frightening to us is really a death. Death isn't kind of a thing that's way out here and difficult to see. It really happens in our daily life where we're faced up with a decision. Am I going to be willing to probably face the desert, the pain, the suffering that's before me, or am I going to wall myself off like I did with my husband for a while there and not face into what I'm afraid of?
Yeah.
Now you're saying, Jack, that understanding who God is helps me do that. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't mean that perhaps the way some people might mean that God is kind of the best drug there is, that I can get so absorbed in my love and knowledge of God that I can forget my pain. I don't mean it that way. What I mean is, I mean it the way Job discovered in the book of Job, that, you know, he's going through all this suffering that God has allowed in his life, has brought into his life, and as I understand the book, basically he keeps asking God for an explanation.
Why, God, am I suffering so horrendously?
Yeah, it's not because I am extraordinarily evil or unrighteous. I'm actually one of the most righteous people I know, God, so why on earth me?
Why me?
Of all the people. And in the end, as I understand the answer the thing that happens at the end in that book, Job repents, it says. He uses that language, he repented. I think what he repented of was the presumption that God owed him an explanation. And the way God persuaded him of that is that he reminded Job of who he was in relationship to Job, who he, God, was in relationship to Job. He was so big, so huge, so all-knowing, so wise, so omnipotent, that he really is the author of all of reality. He's got it completely under control. He knows what he's doing. He knows where he's going. He knows what he wants to accomplish. And he really didn't need any help from Job as a counselor to tell him how to do this thing. That he was completely on schedule in terms of the story that he wanted to tell, both through Job's life and through cosmic history. When we recognize that that's who God is, then we recognize that I'm not going to understand all the suffering that comes in my life. I'm not going to be able to figure out, well, what was the lesson God wanted me to learn, or what was God trying to teach me here, or why did this have to happen? You know, what is he accomplishing here? I could never understand that. I couldn't fathom it because I don't have the depth of the wisdom of God. I don't have a comprehensive understanding of how my life interacts with everything else in the cosmos that God is doing. I can't grasp it. But what I can do is realize who God is, that he's the one who does have a comprehensive grasp of how my life fits into the schemes of things. And if that requires suffering, then it requires suffering. And that's okay with me because I trust the God who's orchestrating all these things. That's the sense in which I mean, when we really come to terms with the reality of who God is and how big he is and how sovereign he is and how much in control as the author of all reality he is, then I can say, if I must go through suffering, then I must go through suffering. So be it.
And the going through suffering may have to be broken up, though, Jack, into very small pieces. Let me give you an example. Say, for example, with me, I just talked about walling off when my husband came home because I was afraid of ultimately being alone. Well, what if, in my experience, I'd actually had somebody, a child, a previous husband, a parent, somebody die, and that had been a very, very traumatic experience for me, or some very big loss had occurred for me? Well, trusting God as the author of my life and being able to risk going forward may mean having to go back and look at and work with the death or the loss of that other person or thing as a way to start working toward being able to open up to my husband. And for some people, we have to go way back. It's turning the pages of the book way back and trusting God with the pain of doing that in order that I can work toward this event that's happening in the present.
Yeah, let me try this on you because if this is your field, it seems...
You can try it on me in just a minute.
Okay.
I see that we need to take another break.
Okay.
You've heard it said that a college degree is not what it used to be. It seems these days colleges and universities are charging more and offering less. That's one of the reasons why Gutenberg College was developed. While many universities brag about their massive size and huge student body, Gutenberg College thrives on the idea that big is not always better. A student should not become a meaningless cog in some big education machine. A student should have the chance to interact in a meaningful way with his or her peers and professors. At Gutenberg, classes are small. Interaction with other students and with faculty is high. And education becomes interesting as well as rewarding. Imagine having a deep discussion about Aristotle or Shakespeare, where your ideas are sincerely considered. Imagine struggling to understand the writings of Augustine and having a faculty tutor come alongside you to help. And you'll get a good idea of why Gutenberg exists. And yet, there are many other advantages to Gutenberg other than its size. If you want to know more about Gutenberg College and all that it offers, call 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. Now, if you didn't have time to write that down, stay tuned. We'll repeat it again at the end of the program. Here again are Jack and Christine.
Just before the break, we were talking about suffering, and we need to have a willingness to risk the pain and suffering, the desert, the darkness that we're inevitably brought into through this life. I was saying that sometimes we have to go way back in our experience and work on issues back there in order to face whatever's present for us here today.
Yeah, it seems to me as part of the process of sanctification that God takes us through. It's a natural part of sanctification that when in the past I have dealt with suffering in my life or trauma in my life by my own devices, that is, I haven't learned wisdom from the trauma. I haven't really come to terms with the reality of who I am and who God is and what this existence is all about. It seems to me that's the right way always to resolve trauma is to put it in the light of truth. and in the light of truth and reality. When I can do that, it will still be painful, but it will not be crazy making. It will not be a problem in my life. It will be a part of what has made me wise. And ultimately, it seems to me, all of the trauma in my life needs to be resolved into wisdom. And if it's not resolved into wisdom, it's going to do something else in my life.
Okay, now I think I know what you're talking about, but I think you need to give us an example.
Well, perhaps one of the most traumatic things that happened in my life is my oldest son, my firstborn son, choked on an almond when he was 2 years old and died. I hope I'm accurate in saying that I came to terms with his death by resolving it into wisdom. And what I meant by that is I asked all those questions that Job did, you know, why me? You know, why my son, God? And God had so prepared me at that point in my life that I was able, through some struggle, but relatively straightforwardly, to recognize God had the right to do that. God was loving me in that event. That was the loving hand of God reaching into my life. It was noteworthy because it was an evidence, an indication that I was a child of God, who God was sanctifying, who God was shaping to make me into the man that he wanted me to be. So I was able to resolve it, I think, in the light of truth, and realize I don't know exactly what's going on, but I know adequately enough what's going on that I can accept the pain, I can accept it. What if I had not done it that way? You know, what if there had been some falsehood in my belief system? What if I had been an unbeliever in a significant sense? For example, one of the questions that you face when your child dies is, where is my child now? Is my child with God in heaven? Or has my child been eternally damned? What's the truth here? And it's very, very tempting at a time like that to say, well, naturally, certainly, my child is in heaven. All children are in heaven. God certainly wouldn't punish innocent children, and so on and so forth. It's very easy to be tempted to think along those lines. What if I had done that? What if I had decided the way I'm going to deal with this pain is to, in part, is to decide my child is in heaven? The problem is, throughout my life later, that would have created a tremendous dissonance in my life, because my study of the Bible has suggested to me that God is sovereign, and that in his sovereignty he chooses whom he will have mercy on. And I really don't see any biblical evidence. I know that this is controversial, many theologians do, but I don't see any biblical evidence to suggest that God's sovereignty does not reach even into the life of infants. So that when an infant dies, it's not a foregone conclusion that God will have mercy on that infant. If we are naturally from conception the sinners that I think the Bible says that we are, God would be fully within his rights to condemn every infant to eternal condemnation. The fact that he would show mercy is in God's hands. It's really ultimately in his hands. God is that sovereign. Well, that's where my Bible study took me in future years. What if I had resolved my pain earlier by believing that my son was in heaven? Rather than recognize that I'm going to have to live with an ultimately unanswerable question for myself, I don't know what God has done. I don't know. Then there would have been a tremendous dissonance created there. Certainly at the theological level, maybe that would have manifested itself in psychological and emotional terms. Now, that's not the best example because I don't, you know, it's not the way it went down for me, and so I can't say here are the emotional or psychological effects of that. You might be able to come up with a better example in that regard than I can, but I think that kind of situation had all the potential for creating a real sort of psychological, irrational psychological effect in my life. And the only way I ever could have resolved it is if through the course of time God had finally brought out into the light of day once again, Jack, we need to revisit this question of your son. Is it or is it not acceptable to you that I am a sovereign God, judge of the whole world, who can do with your son exactly as I please, and I don't need any permission from you, Jack. Is that or is that not acceptable to you? Wisdom will ultimately answer that, God, it is acceptable to me, because who you are gives you the right to deal with us as human beings the way you want to deal with us. As long as I would hold back on that, I would be rebuffing wisdom, stiff-arming wisdom, wanting truth to be what I want truth to be rather than what it is, and would have had to live with all the psychological and emotional fallout of that. But I think as a natural part of my sanctification, God would have ultimately, one way or another, would have had to revisit the question of the death of my son. We need to come to terms with how you think about that again, Jack, because you didn't get it right the first time, and we need to think about it again. Now, it seems to me in counseling, that's oftentimes exactly what you're doing, is helping people revisit past traumas and try to shed the light of reality and truth on them.
In order so that they can go forward in today.
Exactly, yeah.
They've got to look at those things. They become hindrances. And without looking at those, they just remain hindrances, and we have to kind of torque our psyche so that, because the reality doesn't fit with what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just have to switch reality around to try and make it work, and we end up unhealthy people.
Yeah.
What you were saying, Jack, is very, very pregnant, both in the example that you used with your son and your understanding of God's sovereignty and who our sinfulness. Those are really huge theological questions that I hope people don't get hung up on at this point in trying to understand the example you were using. What you're trying to say is we must, during the course of our experience, face into things directly. We must not deny them, put them aside, pretend they're not there, minimize them, act like they're not important, spiritualize them away.
Or trivialize them.
Any of the above and more. But we must face into them straight on.
Yeah.
Part of facing into them straight on means that I understand this circumstance in light of who God is and his love for me, his plan for me, his plan for the world, and I need to look at things in that light. I also need to look at and experience the suffering that comes along with those things. You didn't mention that in your example with your son, but I know you have in past times. Your grief was deep. That was expressed perhaps in waves of grief that came throughout months and years and maybe even today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Still hints of it will crop up at times.
That was, what, over 20 years ago now?
Yeah.
So when you were explaining that, you weren't saying we only look at the truth of God and we rationally understand things. But I also have to go through the grieving process that naturally comes from looking at a painful thing straight on.
Right.
And yes. If I haven't looked at a painful thing straight on, I know it existed, but I haven't allowed myself to deal with it also on an emotional level. That can be something I need to revisit also, because I'm holding back. I'm making a wall so that I don't emotionally have to experience it. Well, then maybe I won't want to experience some other pain that's like it in the present, because experiencing this thing in the present might then trigger the opening of that pain back there. And so I'll just wall myself off again.
Yeah, one of the, along the lines of what you're saying, one of the things that I think I did learn, or I had to come to terms with it, when John David died, is I would find myself feeling pressure, feeling an obligation to grieve for other people. I mean, to grieve on cue, in effect. I mean, I'd find myself actually feeling close to normal in the weeks following the death, and it would occur to me, what's wrong with you, Jack? You know, why are you not just completely in despair and devastated and all upset? Well, what I had to finally realize is it's because I've just been crying my eyes out, and I've purged all that stuff out of me, and now that that's gone for the time being, I feel okay again. And I had
For these moments or these days or...
Yeah. You know, for this hour right now, I don't need to cry because that's been done. And, but I vaguely felt guilty for feeling that way. And so part of what I had to realize is, Jack, it really is okay for your emotions to go where they will go, to reflect what's going on in your life. Your emotions are not a barometer, are not the only indicator and this infallible barometer of how you valued your son.
Mm-hmm.
You know you valued your son.
Mm-hmm.
You know that he was the most precious thing in your life next to your wife. You know that's the case. So let yourself cry when you feel like crying, and let yourself be okay when you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. But there's tremendous temptation to play to the crowd, you know, to be sad, to be morose for the people around me. And I just had to stop myself all the time and say, Jack, cut it out. That's not what your emotions are for. They're not for other people. They're for venting, they're for giving expression to...
the legitimate suffering that's going on inside of you.
Exactly.
And you know, Jack, they are also for other people in this sense. I remember one time when I lived in a small town in California that a friend of ours or an acquaintance had a son who drowned in his backyard. And I remember you going there and being able to uniquely minister to this family because you had gone through this experience and you knew the depth on an emotional level that they were going through at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So had you not grieved it, had you not allowed yourself the venting of those emotions, you might have stiff-armed going to that place because it would have brought back something that was yet unmastered in you, unworked through in you. So you could go to them freely with the recognition and understanding of your own pain and share with them right at the place where they were at.
Yeah, that's true. It's very comforting to know that you can survive these things. But you can't know that you can survive them if you've invested everything in not going through it.
That's right.
In avoiding.
And that's when we don't risk in our marriages. We think we've invested so much in not feeling things or not knowing things that we come into our marriages and we don't want to risk the very necessary things that need to be risked on a daily basis because we've walled ourselves off.
Yeah.
Now, these are really big concepts for people to get their arms around. I know as a counselor, I've watched it many, many, many times where people have had to face into these things. And for me to over and over again understand with people what's going on in them. So as we're talking, I'm thinking, boy, people are really getting a lot of information about how to deal with life and how to risk. And I would say that if you've gotten just a piece of it, that you've gotten a lot, and that understanding these concepts that we're talking about really does take a lot of life.
Yeah.
So let's go back to marriage for a minute.
Okay.
we deviated, and let's just go back to this point. We were talking about marriage as being a commitment to behave in a way that communicates to my spouse that they are special. And in that context, we were saying that we really do need to be willing to take whatever risk, whatever vulnerability that's necessary in order to make our spouse special, as opposed to being selfish, being unwilling to look at the issues we need to in our life, as opposed to walling ourselves off.
You know, maybe we need to give an example of risk-taking. You know, we've talked about risk being involved in either being made special or making the other person special. Do you have an example you could give?
Well, I gave the example of walling myself off from my husband last week. You know, very often we think that risk comes in really big, huge, giant steps. That marriage comes in big, giant steps. If I do something really big right, then, or really big wrong, then that's the measure of my marriage. I don't think that's true at all. It seems to me that being in a marriage is a series of very small steps that I take every day, and as well, very small risks that I might take each day. So let me just give a normal, everyday example of a risk that I might be taking with my spouse. Yesterday, I was gone for a while, actually on a walk with a friend, and when I got home, my daughter was all dressed up. Apparently, my husband had told her that we were going to go out to eat, and so she had gotten dressed in this really cute little outfit. And she said, "Mom, Dad won't let me wear this outfit." And I said, "Well, I don't understand why he wouldn't, because it looks really nice, but let's go talk to him together." So we went in, and I was talking to him about it, and I asked Larry why he was not wanting Leah to wear this outfit, and he was trying to explain it, and I wasn't understanding what he was saying, and I kept on kind of pushing my point, inappropriately so, and saying, "Well, you know, the outfit looks really good, and you're, you know, it just seems like you're being arbitrary. You just want her to change her outfit, and I just don't get it." Finally, he said, "Christine, you just need to trust me on this one." And he said to Leah, "Please go change your outfit." Well, what I didn't want to do at that point was trust him, because I thought he was being arbitrary, and I thought that it was hurtful to our daughter. It took a risk of vulnerability for me to set my own presuppositions aside of what he was doing and be willing to listen to him. It was me not just being the queen, not just thinking I knew everything, but letting him explain what was going on to me. And as it turned out, it really made a whole lot of sense to me why he did that. And I won't go into the whole situation because it would take too long for now. But then what he said to me is, "Christine, I need you to trust me when I make these kinds of decisions and talk to me after the children are gone, because what it appears is so you're kind of undermining my relationship with the children." There again was an opportunity for me to rise up and say, "I wouldn't undermine your relationship with the children. I wouldn't do such a thing." But I had to risk a sort of vulnerability that looked at myself and said, "Yeah, that's indeed what I was doing. And I need to be willing to..." I mean, I didn't intend to do that, but I can see how the kids would perceive it in that way. And I need to be willing to see I didn't make a good decision there. And it's kind of a swallowing down of my pride. Now, that's just a very small example, but what I could have done was say, "How can you tell me that I'm undermining the kids?" I could just be defensive in whatever way. And so the taking on the responsibility to hear, to drop my pride, to listen to him, to be vulnerable to whatever those things mean, is a responsibility that I have all the time in my relationship with him.
Now, why are you calling setting your pride aside a risk?
Because it hurts. Because I want to think of myself as being right. I have a particular problem of wanting to be right. And it's hard for me to see myself as having done it wrong. I think I have corresponded being right with being loved.
So the risk is that if you are not who you would prefer to think of yourself as, then the risk is maybe you will be nothing. Maybe you will be not significant. Maybe you will not be loved. Maybe you will not be accepted.
Exactly.
That's the risk.
Exactly.
We'll return to Jack and Christine in a moment as they conclude their discussion on breaking the marriage vows. Christine Barber has been a marriage and family therapist for over 20 years. Every day, she works alongside people who desperately need the application of biblical Christianity in their lives. Not only as a therapist, but also as a wife and mother, Christine sees the radical message of the Bible and the truth it contains, providing the only real foundation upon which people can understand their lives and have hope in this world. Jack Crabtree is a professional philosopher, theologian, and teacher. For several years, he was on the pastoral staff of Peninsula Bible Church in Palo Alto, California. He has been teaching at McKenzie Study Center, as well as the University of Oregon, Oregon State University, and Gutenberg College for a number of years. He is one of the pastors at Reformation Fellowship in Eugene, Oregon. Jack's passion is first to understand the biblical text, then to apply that text and its principles in a consistent way to everyday life. Now, once again, here are Jack and Christine as they conclude their discussion on the breaking of marriage vows.
In the last hour, Jack, you and I have talked about marriage being a commitment to behaving in a way that communicates that my spouse is very special. And as we were talking, one of the thoughts that went through my mind was, how have I done that in my relationship with my own husband? And I would like to be able to look back and say, I've done a really good job affirming him, making him feel special, respecting him, making him feel valued, cherished, important, meeting his need for those things. And I think to some extent I have done that. But I think looking over the almost 20 years of our marriage, there's so many times when I haven't done that, and it makes me really sad. I would like to think that in the next 20 years that I will get better and better at doing that. I watched him yesterday teach a class at a church, and I was impressed by the way he was able to speak and the power of his words. Not that he spoke in a really powerful way, but just the depth and meaning and the way he communicated had so much fullness to it. I would like to think that there was a lot that I contributed to his being able to be confident enough in what he thinks and how he feels and who he is. I think every day I need to be reminded. I need to remind myself of how can I make Larry special. Today we talked a lot about making our spouse special by being willing to take risks, by being willing to be vulnerable. I need to be willing to be more vulnerable, more and more vulnerable in my life, to instead of in my pride rising up and saying I won't look at the issues that are brought before me in my marriage by God, I need to be willing to face into the suffering or the darkness or the pain of being lonely, of not being significant myself, of seeing myself as God sees me. That's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah. In addition to just the risk-taking that's always involved, there are, of course, all kinds of little symbols and tokens and expressions of the specialness of my spouse. And, you know, it would be tempting to list 50 things that you can do for your spouse to show them that they're special. But I think that that misses the whole point, that each couple, each individual is going to find their own way of doing that. And no one way is more valid than the other. What's critical is that the heart be there. It's not the outward external expressions of it. It's what's in the heart, or what is the commitment of my deep inner being.
And if the heart is there, if I'm really in my inner being committed to the specialness of my spouse, then there will be little things that I understand that I can do for my spouse that communicate to them that they're special to me.
And part of it is I will know them, and so I will know what way to express that will be meaningful to them.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Next week, Jack and Christine continue the discussion on keeping and breaking marriage vows. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, Thank you for listening.